Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of unobtainium. Greetings from the boldest, bawdiest, most outrageous city in the world, the planetary capital of sun, fun, sin, sex, and secrets, my not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. My name is George Knapp, your occasional host, designated driver of the airwaves, and moderator of tonight's upcoming cacophonous cavalcade of conversation. 1 month down in the new year, you probably have not acclimated yourselves to writing checks with the correct year, right? Okay, that's me, not you. Storms pounding much of the country tonight. Good excuse to hunker down indoors, throw a log on the fire, and spend a few hours with us. I've been looking forward to this program for a couple of months now. Call it our first UFO Palooza of 2021. Taking a look back at significant events of the last year and a look ahead to what might be coming this year and beyond with three guests who have lifetimes of experience investigating, analyzing UFO cases and data. They are mainstays of a relatively young UFO UAP organization called the SCU, the Scientific Coalition for UFO or UAP Studies, serious, sober, scientific folks who have initiated several data-driven UFO investigations. The organization started out as an offshoot of MUFON, then it morphed into its own separate entity, a 501c3. You won't see them engaging in food fights or hissy fits on Twitter or calling people names or speculating about secret CIA cabals or deep state disinfo plots. They look for evidence, and then they share it with the world. Rich Hoffman, Robert Powell, and Kevin Knuth are veteran researchers and investigators. They don't suffer fools. They don't wallow in conspiracies. Instead, they look for facts and have done some remarkable work already, with more work on the way. They'll be my guests for the full 4 hours tonight, although I think Kevin will have to leave us earlier than that. He has a job. Imagine that. And we promise to answer your questions in the last hour. Save that last hour for you. So think of some good stuff to ask. Give us your A game, folks. Think about what you might want to ask, and we'll have a full hour for your calls. As a way to get the juices flowing and ideas popping, webmaster Lex and I have put together our usual assortment of items and oddities culled from the world's news media. We call it Knapp's News. You can find it on the Coast to Coast AM website. Among the stories posted there tonight, several relating to our central topic in this program. An interesting piece about the intelligence that might be waiting out there for us to discover, or for it to discover us, I guess. A prominent scientist who's been my guest on this program in the past thinks there is likely an artificial alien intelligence, maybe more than one, out there, an alien race so advanced that they don't have bodies anymore. They left those behind. They exist sort of in the ether, billions of years older than humans. Also, another story from Forbes, yes, Forbes, writing about aliens, suggesting that if there are aliens out there, and if they are hostile, they are not likely to hide from us. We'd know about it eventually, and not in a good way. That's kind of cheery to know. A story from Popular Science about the UAP task force and the paper it's writing to be submitted to Congress later this year, something we will be discussing in detail tonight. And we have a final clip from our TV interview with Robert Bigelow. Remember his appearance on 60 Minutes back in 2017? He made this striking comment to the correspondent Lara Logan about aliens being right here under our noses. What did he mean when he said that? Well, we tried to pry a bit more info out of him. You can see that and more on Knapp's News. And while you're on the website, check out how to become a Coast Insider. The cost is pennies a day if you subscribe for a year. Gives you access to a vast archive of previous programs and interviews, including the Art Bell Vault. You can listen anytime you want, not only in the middle of the night, but listen as many times as you want in case you miss something juicy. It's a great deal. Same is true for George Norrie's television program, Beyond Belief. It, too, is available by prescription and always has stellar interviews with interesting guests, so check it out. And with that, let's assume the position. Bring in the dog and the cat and the goat and the chicken. It's too cold outside for the critters. Put on a pot of Strong Joe, slide your bod into those heavy flannel PJs and your toes into the plush bunny slippers, plop yourself down in a comfy spot, turn down the lights and turn up the radio because we're about ready to rumble. In a moment, the brainiacs from the Scientific Coalition for UAP Studies, Rich Hoffman, Robert Powell, Kevin Knuth, and the state of ufology today. I'm George Knapp, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. The SCU was established back in 2017, which, as you'll recall, was a pretty momentous year for UFO news. First, it was within MUFON, then as its own organization. One of the founding members is Rich Hoffman. Rich was my guest a while back. I'm so glad he's returned and brought friends. He's a 26-year defense contractor working at the Redstone Arsenal in Alabama for Army Materiel Command HQ. He's a senior systems engineer analyst, and for the past 56 years, he's been engaged in investigating and researching the UAP phenomena. Robert Powell is a founding board member of the Scientific Coalition for UAP Studies. He was the director of research at MUFON from 2007 to 2017 and created MUFON Science Review Board in 2012. He's one of two authors of a detailed radar witness report on the Stephenville lights. You'll remember that case, and we'll talk about it. The 2013 Aguadilla, Puerto Rico case, and is the primary author on a recently published paper. It's an analysis of the Navy Carrier Strike Group encounter with the Tic Tac. He also has a new book out written for young people on how to introduce them to the UAP topic. Kevin Knuth is an associate professor in the Department of Physics at the University of Albany, SUNY, State University of New York, and is the editor-in-chief of the journal Entropy. He's a former NASA research scientist at NASA Ames in the Intelligence Systems Division, designing artificial intelligence algorithms for astrophysical data analysis. He's published more than 100 peer-reviewed publications and has been invited to give over 80 presentations in 14 countries, written some excellent papers that we're going to discuss tonight. Gentlemen, great to have you all here.
Great to be here, George. Thank you for having us.
I'm thrilled. We got a lot of ground to cover, so I'm going to jump right into it. Rich, let's start with you. Can you give us an overview about SCU, what it was created to do, how things are going now? And I'll frame the question this way, too. We know what SCU isn't. We don't see it thrashing it out with knuckleheads on Twitter, getting into spats or name-calling and conspiracy theories. How do you manage to avoid all that and still get things done? And what is it your organization does?
Well, thanks for having us on, and thanks for spending so much time this evening with us, George. We appreciate the opportunity to be able to share what we're about. Five of us got started with the case investigation of the Aguadilla case back in 2013. And we were just a team that was comprised of all of us in MUFON, and just a team that was put together to basically go out and analyze this case, because we had to sign an NDA saying that we wouldn't, you know, basically talk about it and we wouldn't share it with anybody. And so we did that kind of thing in order to be able to protect the pilot's identity and various other aspects of the case. But as we went along and we finished our Aguadilla report after about 2 years, by that time, you know, we were starting to receive a little bit of pushback from MUFON that we didn't go through them, but we, again, honored the witness's decision to not do that. And so after a period of time, and I think it got around to about the 2017 time period, that we kind of decided that it was best for us to just break on our own. And we started to see that MUFON wasn't going exactly the way we wanted it to be. They were talking about secret spaceship programs, and that's not something of interest to many of the scientists we had on board. And in fact, we were starting to see a lot of them, you know, wanting to, you know, leave, basically. So we decided to about maybe like 2016 to look into the idea of creating an organization. By 2017, we actually got it organized and got all the paperwork in and started to pull the organization together. At present, we've got, I think it's like the last number, and Robert can probably correct me, it's probably, I think, about 109 people that are a part of us. And I think that there's like something about 24% of those with PhDs. And, you know, with the events in 2017 that came up, the big, you know, I mean, with the announcement at the Pentagon, it just gave a lot of legs to be able to stand on. And we started to see people that were coming out with, you know, good credentials, like, you know, we're pleased to have Dr. Kevin Knuth on board with us and his colleague, Dr. Matthew Shadegas, and a whole host of others that wanted to sign up and be a part of a, you know, treating this subject seriously and scientifically. And, so we forged ahead. Robert, me, and a few of the other people on the board, we actually got it established, and it's we do our best, George, to be able to stay out of that fray you mentioned, because we're not interested in playing into that role. We're We're more focused on being able to do our scientific work, which is to be able to do studies and to get data, to be able to do the studies and to write papers and to be able to help push that into scientific journals. And that's the way we see going about it. So we're more like a think tank, and we've got a large number of projects that we're engaged in right now, and we're just pushing ahead. So that's pretty much about us and where we're planning to go anyway.
Robert, a related question. So you've quietly done some of the best and most credible, comprehensive work, these excellent analyses of the Stephenville case, which a lot of people have sort of forgotten, the Aguadilla case that we'll talk about. How did you end up with SCU? Did you leave MUFON? Are you still affiliated?
No, I left MUFON in the summer of 2017, and we created SCU as a nonprofit in September of 2017.
You don't have to wait for disclosure. There's data out there that can be analyzed and discussed. You don't need to wait for handouts from the government, right?
Right. Yeah, I'm not a big fan of the word disclosure. Whether the government ever comes out and says, here's everything we know, I don't think that will ever happen. But there's lots of good information out there that can be analyzed, and hopefully, maybe someday in the future, the government can provide more information that can be analyzed.
Kevin, I'm told you'll be here for just maybe this hour, so I want to focus on you a little bit in this first hour and give you as much attention.
Yeah, I'll try to stay as long as I can.
Yeah, understood. You have a job. I get that. I read that your first exposure to the UFO subject came because of some cattle mutilations in your neck of the woods, and someone told you about a possible UFO connection. You kind of scoffed and walked away. Obviously, something changed. What was it?
Well, it was a few things. That's right. That was my first real encounter, so to speak. I was starting graduate school in physics in the physics department at Montana State University in Bozeman, Montana. And this would have been in the fall of 1988. And it was the second week of classes or so. And so I was a new student along with many other new graduate students who'd moved to Montana to go to school. And there were these two cattle mutilations on a nearby ranch, and it was all over the news, and it was pretty freaky. And so several of us students, physics students, were discussing this in the hallway of the physics building, mainly trying to get our heads around what kind of strange place we all just moved to and are going to have to spend the next several years at, right? And and while we were having this heated discussion, one of the physics professors came down the hall to see what we were all excited about, and he kind of listened and politely and then said, yeah, that's very strange, the cattle mutilations, they happen around here, and no one ever figures out what causes them or what, you know, who the culprits are, and very often UFOs are, you know, seen around the same time or in the same area, so it's very strange. And then he said, but what's even stranger, he said, is I have some friends who work up at Malmstrom Air Force Base at the ICBM missile sites, and they have problems up there with UFOs flying over the missiles and shutting them down. And we were kind of stunned. verify this. It was, UFOs are shutting down nuclear missiles, and he said, that's what they tell me. And you know, he walked away, and to be honest, we laughed. We laughed like crazy, because that just sounds like something that's nuts, right? I mean, we would all know about this. The government would be doing something. Somebody would do something about it. And so we just saw it. And so it can't possibly be true, but it wasn't. So it wasn't until I was here at UAlbany and I was teaching an astronomy class, and I had some students interested in the possibilities of aliens, extraterrestrial life in the first place, and also the possibility of them visiting Earth. And so they wanted me to say some things about that. So I was, the evening before my lecture, I was kind of poking around on the internet, and I happened upon the press conference that Robert Hastings had given with Robert Salas and several other people who were at Malmstrom Air Force Base, and they were recounting their experiences in the 1960s with UFOs shutting down nuclear missiles. And I thought, I heard about this 30 years ago when I was in graduate school. I thought it was crazy, but it can't possibly be crazy if you have this many people over that length of time talking about these experiences. And so I became convinced that something's going on, something strange is happening, and people are ignoring it because they just think it's nuts, but clearly can't be.
Has the ground changed in the last 3 years for you, for your colleagues who presumably would be interested in this? You know, the guys at Ames Lab, you would think that guys working for NASA would be all over this subject, would be completely fascinated, would want to dig into it. I wonder if the ground has changed for people like that, colleagues in different disciplines, in the last 3 years, now that the Navy has made some public statements and the Tic Tac information has come spilling out.
A good bit. It hasn't. Their scientists are now mildly interested. They're not immediately dismissive, which I think is good. So some of the taboo has lifted, and maybe we're shifting toward more healthy skepticism, which is better than just being dismissive of the whole thing, which isn't healthy. And I've been contacted by several colleagues who have expressed interest in finding out how one can go about studying these things. And so I think that's very promising. Surprisingly, you mentioned colleagues at NASA. My colleagues at NASA really think that this is just nuts and are not interested. And that kind of surprises me. I should mention that one of my former colleagues in the same division, the Intelligence Systems Division, Silvano Colombano, had written a paper for a SETI meeting more recently where he was talking about how we ought to be studying UFOs as well. So some people are, I think, coming around and realizing that, you know, maybe we should look at this. Maybe we should look at the data rather than just laugh it away.
Yeah, you would think that the SETI folks would be interested, but of course, as we know, they're kind of hostile to the whole UFO subject. They think they're aliens out there, but way, way far away, not closer to home. And so they belittle the general topic, even though SETI doesn't exactly have a great track record in terms of coming up with data. You know that there is data here that can be analyzed and written about.
Right. And I think, well, that's interesting. And I think the difficulty with SETI is they have, for their entire history, they've been worried about being taken seriously by the scientific community and worried about funding, consequently. So I think that they're rather gun shy. They don't want to be more fringe than they already are. And I think that's the problem. And that may change when, you know, with more information coming out. We'll see. We'll have to see.
I want to jump into the Nimitz Tic Tac case because that's such a monumentally important turning point for the discussion. Robert, you've done a lot of work digging into that. I know that Jeremy Corbell and I were working on it months before the New York Times story came out, and we could see your footprints at a couple of different places trying to dig up information yourself. Is that case a game changer in your mind?
Oh, I think it's definitely a game changer. I mean, it's really brought attention to the subject. I started working on the case in January of 2016, about a year and a half before the New York Times incident. And it's amazing because I generated all of these FOIAs, and I got the same response back from every Navy agency. You know, even though today they indicate, yes, these UAPs exist, Back then being 2016 and 17, the reply was always, we don't have any information responsive to your request. And then finally, I protested some FOIAs, and I got one back where I guess they wanted to throw me some crumbs. So it was an email exchange between some Marine officers on a ship, and in that conversation, this JAG officer, who was trying to get information about my FOIA request, asked them a question, and they said, Tic Tacs? Oh, yeah, we know all about the Tic Tacs.
I'll tell you what, hold on, Robert. Robert and Kevin and Rich, we'll be right back. We're talking with the three mainstays from the SCU, an organization created to UFO UAP studies, Rich Hoffman, Robert Powell, Kevin Knuth. When we come back, we're going to take a deeper dive into the Nimitz-Princeton Tic Tac case, what it was and what it isn't. We'll be right back. Kevin Knuth, I know that you have taken a pretty deep dive into that Nimitz-Princeton Tic Tac case. Can I get you to share with us your conclusions about it, what you think it is and is not, based on the data and the video?
Right. Let's see. Basically, we had analyzed the last 30-some frames of that video where the object accelerates off to the left and the computer system loses lock. And given the approximate, you know, the estimated size by the pilots, by four individuals who witnessed the thing, they estimated the object to be about 40 feet across. And if that's correct or close, then that acceleration was around 75 Gs of acceleration, about 75 times the acceleration of gravity. And which is incredibly fast. It's much faster than you would expect a missile frame to be able to handle. So it's faster than anything we're going to make that's in operation. So it's really pretty startling. Now, of course, if the pilots were in error about the size of the object, then you know that number is going to change. So, but they're proportional. So if the object was a drone only 4 feet in length, then the acceleration would have been around 7.5 Gs, which would still be crazy acceleration for a drone, especially when you've got infrared footage that doesn't show any heat signatures from exhaust. So it appears that these are actually craft based on the descriptions of the pilots. And the accelerations are really pretty astounding. Based on Kevin Day's report, Senior Chief Day was on the USS Princeton monitoring these things using radar, and he observed one dropping from about 28,000 feet to sea level in about 0.7 seconds. So those accelerations are really very high. So the minimum acceleration in that case is going to be, we estimated it to be something on the order of 5,000 to 6,000 Gs, so about 5,000 times the acceleration of gravity. So the mean acceleration was 5,950 Gs, which is really insane. No organisms are going to survive that, much less equipment. So these objects are really quite astounding. And the thing that I found interesting is that if the amount of power involved is very high, we, of course, to calculate how much power would be required to complete such a maneuver, you'd have to know the mass of the craft. And the object was about the same size as an F-18, which is around, I think, 15,000 kilograms. So we lowballed the mass to about 1,000 kilograms. So if the thing was rather light, it still would require about 1,100 gigawatts to perform that maneuver. So it's 1,100 billion watts of power. And to put that into perspective, the maximum power output of the United States is only around 90 gigawatts. The maximum power output of our nuclear power output by the United States is around 90 gigawatts. So, and the Palo Verde Nuclear Generating Station in Arizona is the is the biggest nuclear power plant and only puts out 3.3 gigawatts. So this was 300 times more power than the Palo Verde nuclear generating station it would have required. So this technology, you know, people have often suggested, well, could it be possible that somebody leapfrogged in technology? Well, they would have leapfrogged multiple times to be able to get to this point. So it really is a shocking. These maneuvers were really quite shocking. Now, one can then ask, well, is it reasonable to assume that these, or hypothesize that these could be extraterrestrial craft? And you then have to worry about interstellar travel in that case. But if you're seeing accelerations on the order of 5,000 Gs, and if that acceleration could be sustained in space for any period of time, you could easily get up to relativistic speeds, which would be speeds close to the speed of light. So, for example, for even at 1,000 G acceleration, if you can maintain that for about an hour, you'll be going about a tenth of the speed of light already. 3 hours, you're going 30% the speed of light. That's faster than the probes we're trying to design now to go to Alpha Centauri. And if you can sustain that acceleration at 1,000 Gs for 17 hours, you'll be going 90% the speed of light. So could these be interstellar craft? They certainly could.
Rich, you've heard the explanations from people who desperately don't want this to be, they want it to be anything but an unknown. So they'll say, well, that video is kind of grainy. It doesn't really impress me. And they'll say, it could be a hologram. And then they'll say, it's a secret drone project that it's classified, hasn't been unveiled. And they're just kind of springing it on this Navy unit just to test it out. What do you say to those folks?
Well, I mean, that's a good point, George. I mean, even if you go back to, like, you know, take a look at the Kenneth Arnold case. I know that Dr. Bruce McAbee wrote a book just recently about that case. And in it, he cites 14 different alternative hypotheses for what Kenneth Arnold saw. And so it's quite common to have people who want to come out and to say that, you know, it's something, it's this or it's that, whatever it is. And so we see that on a lot of different cases, and especially the people out wanting to debunk the case will come up with something. But as we've seen in the past, even with the Agua Dia case, what we've seen is they'll take just a very small perspective. They might have already developed an opinion, like it's got to be a balloon. And so therefore, I'm going to just work and fit all the facts to being a balloon. And they failed to look at the entire picture of the case. And, you know, for example, they're not looking at the thermal signatures, which don't match a balloon. They're not looking at the other aspects of it. And so we get that quite often. And I'll be honest with you, it's like we've attempted to deal with it in the context of even the Agua Dia case, where we post up some of these alternative, you know, things, and we try to like show, well, again, this is why it doesn't work, because we did consider that. And so, yeah, George, I mean, it's part of the UFO history from the very beginning that you're going to continue to have people that want to offer an explanation for it. We see it often online. If you take a look at, like, even in social media, somebody will go up and post a video, and then you have these, you know, this chair of speculation, or you know, the people sitting back wanting to dodge it. Well, it's a bird, it's this, it's that. And it's, I think part of it has to be with human nature, but at the same time, you know, they're not, you know, looking at the facts. And so we just deal with what we know, and we encourage people to write, you know, competing papers and to consider some of the other alternatives. But I think that's just part of the UFO history.
Robert, this incident happened in 2004, so we're coming up on almost 17 years ago. If it's a secret technology developed by the U.S. military, when are we going to see it? You know, let's break it on out here. It's been a long time. You don't believe that's secret technology that we developed, right?
No, there's no way. The characteristics that this object displayed, even, you know, if you project where we'll be in 20 or 30 years, this is not like developing a B-2 stealth bomber. I mean, this is orders of magnitude beyond our capabilities. For example, you have an object that's traveling through the air at these high accelerations that Kevin just mentioned, and its speed is at tens of thousands of miles an hour at low atmosphere. It should have been a fireball, like a meteor burning up in the atmosphere. We have no metals that could survive movement through the atmosphere at that speed. I mean, even a hypersonic missile, which can travel at 5,000-6,000 miles an hour, we make it out of a special metal, and the metal is almost melting as it's moving through the atmosphere. There's nothing that we have that can move through the atmosphere at that speed without burning up.
I know that you and I were both trying to find documents, anything, reports that had been written for the Navy or Pentagon or DIA or anybody, and it was pretty hard going there until, I think there was a report that was written for the Navy, and it just got stuck in a drawer, which meant that people like you could not obtain it. And we got an analysis that was done a while later under the auspices of OSAP that really spells it out, that our military did not know what this was. They were trying to figure it out, but it's pretty clear when you read that paper, it's not ours.
Right, exactly. It's not ours. The Navy indicates, what most people have to realize, this was a Navy carrier strike group. That is one of the most powerful systems on our planet, that the U.S. has 10 of these. And you've got radar on every one of those ships. You've got the highest technology of computer systems that are coordinating the radar systems. And for someone to think that our pilots and our Navy seamen are not aware of everything that's in the air around that air carrier strike group, that, they're deceiving themselves. Because if it's there and it is Russian, Chinese, or commercial aircraft, anything, they know what it is almost immediately.
Kevin, you have written about sort of the spread of intelligence and civilizations through the cosmos. I'd like to address this while we have you still here about who it might be, who might have been responsible for Tic Tac, for the gimbal, if it's not us. We don't know. We don't have good evidence for where it might come from. We can't prove it's extraterrestrial. You've explored the possibility that it's a breakaway civilization. I think you called it a Wakanda. Can you talk about that in connection with your bigger paper about intelligence in the cosmos?
Oh, certainly. Yeah. Well, when I mentioned Wakanda, Professor Shadagas, Matthew Shadagas, and I here at UAlbany, we use that as in the context of what we call the Wakanda hypothesis, which is the hypothesis that it is that these things were made by somebody here on Earth, another country that's far ahead of everybody else. But the idea, but I have looked into what an interstellar civilization would have to be like to be able to find Earth, and how difficult it would be to find Earth, and all of this. Now, the difficulty is that if you can go at sufficiently fast speeds, close to the speed of light, you have several effects in relativity that work with you. Of course, there are some that work against you as well. And the ones that work with you are what we call time dilation, where the faster you go, your time slows down. So it's true that traveling, to the nearest star would take a very long time. The nearest star is about 4 light years away. So if you're traveling close to the speed of light, that will take you almost 4 years to get there. But for the traveler, because they're moving, their time is going slower. So they can actually get there in a shorter period of time. And as close as you get to the speed of light, you can make that arbitrarily small. So it could take them a few days to a few weeks, whatever you like. So it is possible to make trips like this. Now, the problem with a trip like that is that you can travel a long distance in a short period of time. So if let's say we're accelerating at something close to a, let's drop it down to 100 G acceleration, which is about 50 times less acceleration than was witnessed by Kevin Day. You can get from here to the other side of the galaxy, which is a little more than 100 light years from here. It would only take you almost 4 months to get there, ship time. If you accelerated at 100 G constantly and then decelerated at 100 G the rest of the way. So for the traveler, it would only take about 4 months. For people on Earth, it would take 120,000 years, something crazy like that. So the problem is that if you then have somebody travels from across the galaxy and then turns around and goes back home, when they get home, it will have been an 8-month trip for the traveler, but it will have been about 250,000 years for everybody on the planet that they're from. So space travel becomes time travel. Basically, you are traveling through space at very high speeds is equivalent to traveling forward in time. And so the idea, the thinking has been, well, why would anybody ever do that? Because there's no point traveling to another star system to collect information, because when you come back, who are you going to give it to? You know, the people who funded the project aren't ever going to hear from you. So why would anybody ever do that? And it occurred to me one day that wasn't very reasonable thinking, because, well, first, you know, people are crazy. People do all sorts of crazy things. And so I would do that. I would take a trip like that if I had the opportunity, didn't have a family, didn't worry about not seeing them again. But then, of course, when I came back to Earth after going to the other side of the galaxy, it's going to be 250,000 years into the future, and that would be a lot of fun to see that too. But you have nobody to share it with. And you can easily solve this problem by traveling with friends. So you form a nomadic society of travelers, and you can actually arrange to travel to different places. So you travel off to this area of the galaxy. I'm going to travel in the opposite direction to that area of the galaxy. And if we time everything right, you and I will come back, meet back here on Earth about 250,000 years from now. We can then compare notes.
Well, you know, or they just stay here. Maybe they live here, you know, permanently. We're talking with Kevin Knuth, Robert Powell, Rich Hoffman of SCU. Kevin, are you sticking around, or you got to go? I don't hear Kevin. Okay, I think maybe Kevin dropped. We'll see if he's coming back, but in the meantime, we're going to take a little break.